Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We will begin today with not one, not two, but three New York Times columnists who have all magically appeared in our studio this morning. I cannot claim that this is the first time Michelle Goldberg, Ross Douthat, and David Leonhardt have appeared anywhere together. In fact, as some of you know, the reason they're here as an ensemble is that they do a weekly podcast together called The Argument, which to my ear is more of a really good conversation than an actual argument, but that's a good thing. It is still these three people with three different takes on the news and on life on Earth in general, and they've been writing about things like, and see, listeners, if you can guess who wrote which, the spiritual importance of presidential hopeful Marianne Williamson to Democrats, even if many don't recognize it, why Donald Trump humiliating one of his appointees is a good thing, and why the Dems have room to move to the left on many issues, but they shouldn't do it on all of them at once. And as you ponder that matching question, which we will reveal the answers to, here are Michelle Goldberg, Ross Douthat, and David Leonhardt. Thanks for coming in together for this. Welcome back, all of you, to WNYC.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us,
Thanks
Brian.
Thanks for having us.
And listeners, don't call in yet. Let us set up some of our guests' threads and ideas, and then we'll open the phones and you can argue along. Ross, I saw you describe yourself in a recent column as a cultural conservative. Is that the same as a religious conservative, or how would you define it?
It overlaps, I suppose. I mean, I think that my views are probably informed in obvious ways by the fact that I'm some kind of conservative Roman Catholic, with a lot of the political views that that entails, including being pro-life, or we can just call it anti-abortion. I think the flat way of saying it sometimes sounds better. But I think for the purposes of our arguments, it's also I think what sort of matters about my own perspective is that I was, like many conservatives on op-ed pages around the country, anti-Trump in 2016. It's quite possible that I'll be anti-Trump again in 2020, though I'm not giving that away just yet. You have to keep some suspense. But I'm also a lot more sympathetic, I think, broadly speaking, to populism as a force than a lot of conservative critics of Trump. And I think that there is a possible political movement in the space of economic populism and social or cultural conservatism that, from my perspective, could be a force for good and that I would want to support, which tends to separate me from my colleagues on the show.
Yes. And so, Michelle, do you have a label for your basic worldview or some brief description that's your equivalent of what we just heard from Ross?
You know, I'm not sure that I do. I think that I am, you know, When I hang out with my friends on the left, I'm comparably a neoliberal sellout, although I am definitely on, probably was one of the most left-wing people that the New York Times has ever had on the op-ed page. You know, I was someone who was thrilled to campaign and vote for Barack Obama and have been somewhat radicalized by the rise of Trump, the intellectual collapse of the Republican Party, and, you know, this sort of growing sense that people further to my left had before I did, that the kind of plutocratic strain in American capitalism is deeply corrupt and corrosive to democracy. And I would also describe myself as a feminist, and so I bring the lens of gender to a lot of these debates, and that's a lens that's become really salient when you have a president who has been credibly accused of rape and is a self-confessed sexual assaulter.
And so, David, you're the one in this trio who I have a little harder time understanding your unique role. Aren't you pretty much a liberal or progressive in the vein of what Michelle, except you're not a woman, was just describing?
In some ways, yes. And we don't pretend that the three of us either as a group represent the American political public opinion.
Right.
I mean,
sure.
We are clearly to the left of where the American people are as a group. But I would describe myself as center left. And I think that there are a bunch of issues in which I'm to Michelle's right. There's obviously a longer list of issues in which I'm to Ross's left. The thing I guess I would add, the two things I would add are, one, Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, has this nice line that he argues that people who were paying attention to the evidence should have moved right on economic matters in the last 20 years of the 20th century. I know some people disagree with that. And should have moved left on economic matters in the 21st century. And that describes roughly what I've done, meaning my economic views have moved to the left because of what's happened with living standards and inequality. And so I think that's one thing that distinguishes me from some people on the center left. The other thing is I'm actually more open to a lot of versions of social conservatism than many other progressives are. I'm comfortable saying that it's better to have kids grow up in two-parent families than one-parent families on average. I don't think it matters whether they're straight or gay couples. I think education is more central to living standards than many progressives do, who they would say the system's rigged, college isn't worth it. I think college is worth it, and I think if you look at what people do with their own kids, you know, we see that. And while if forced to choose a label, I would certainly choose pro-choice, I absolutely understand why huge numbers of Americans, including roughly equal numbers of women and men, are deeply uncomfortable with abortion and the idea of ending a pregnancy because of non-life-threatening issues involving the child.
And listeners, if you're just tuning in, our guests are three New York Times columnists, David Leonhardt, who was just speaking, Michelle Goldberg, and Ross Douthat. They all take part in the weekly New York Times podcast, The Argument, and we're doing a sort of Brian Lehrer Show edition today. Hold off on your phone calls. We'll open them up after our guests talk a little bit more. And so for the first reveal from the matching game that I set up in the introduction, David, you're the one who wrote that just because the Democrats have room to move to the left on some issues doesn't mean that they're wise to move left on all of them. Would you elaborate on that?
So the American people, when you look at polling, are very progressive on economic matters. They're in favor of a higher minimum wage. They're in favor of more government health care. They're in favor of more government efforts to provide good jobs. They're in favor of much higher taxes on the rich. They're in favor of a wealth tax. They're in favor of higher tax on corporation. I could keep going. And so I think on those basic economic matters, Democrats, not only from a policy perspective, but from a political perspective, are right to move to the left. But the list of things that they're moving to the left on isn't just restricted to that. They aren't simply saying we should have more government health care. They're saying, hey, it's fine to ban private insurance. I think that's a mistake to use our capital on banning, political capital on banning private insurance instead of saying attacking climate change. I also think it's deeply inconsistent with public opinion. And I agree with Michelle that the Trump presidency is an emergency. And so to me, Democrats shouldn't be out there talking about banning private health insurance when it potentially could risk helping Donald Trump win re-election.
So there's that one. You also mentioned free public college for all. Maybe no, because no need to subsidize the wealthy, and abandoning Democrats' traditional support for rigorous immigration enforcement. And I'm going to stay with you for one more question, because that's so relevant to how Trump will probably run for re-election.
Yes, it is. Our colleague Jamel Bowie has a really nice column today in which he sort of says, why isn't Trump moving to the center on any of these issues? And there are many answers to that. But to me, part of the answer is he's assuming that he will effectively be able to move to the center because of the Democrats moving to the left. And I think immigration, excuse me, may be the biggest risk for Democrats, because Democrats, unlike Barack Obama, have gotten uncomfortable with the idea of talking about any kind of border security, talking about any kind of deportations except for the worst criminals. And first of all, I don't think that's good policy. As I said, I take the rise in inequality really seriously, which means I think we need to think about immigration levels. It's clearly bad politics. If you look at the polls, Americans are overwhelmingly, they're not in favor of Donald Trump's border wall, but they are overwhelmingly in favor of stronger border security, and many of them are anxious about illegal immigration.
Michelle, anything to compare and contrast on this? Your columns have emphasized, you know, the terrible things Trump is doing in our name.
Well, I would say a couple of things. I mean, first of all, I would disagree with David that all of the Democrats are calling for an abolition of private health insurance, right? That's the position of Bernie Sanders. It's the position of Elizabeth Warren. And we could argue about it on the merits and the political, you know, the sort of political viability of it. But it is a live debate within the Democratic primary as opposed to a consensus position. You know, I think, and it was funny, I was just watching Kamala Harris last night talk about the importance of border security. And so it's, my sense is not that they've basically, that the Democratic Party is for open borders. And even the position of decriminalizing migration, which has become an increasingly salient position in the Democratic primary, I think people misunderstand that to say that we're, that means that anybody can come in, as opposed to that it would be a civil rather than a criminal offense, right? So you could still deport people, you could put people even in detention, you just couldn't put them in the criminal justice system and in jail. And given that there's, I think, a fairly widespread consensus that we have too many people in prison in this country, and that, you know, this kind of tough on crime response to all sorts of social problems has been a disaster, I'm not sure why immigration would be different. I do think that there is a political problem for Democrats in that probably the general public is, I think, a little bit schizophrenic on immigration, right? They're kind of immigration restrictionist when they actually see what that looks like in practice, seeing people deported in their neighborhood, when they realize, you know, well, no, not the good people, right? When they realize what that means, they tend to react against it. But the idea that, you know, if Democrats kind of go back to where Barack Obama was, that they will be less vulnerable to these kind of demagogic attacks, to me, is belied by the fact that Trump is president in the first place, right? So you did have a president, Barack Obama, who deported more people than any others, who was kind of fairly hawkish on border security. And, you know, so I think there was people in the Obama administration who believed that that was good policy, but there was also people who believed that it was good politics, that this is how you neutralize those attacks. Obviously, that didn't work. You're going to get these attacks regardless. So maybe you should just do what you think is both humane and good policy.
Yeah. And Ross, you wrote a column called Between Folly and Cruelty on Immigration. Do you find that line in a similar place to what David was describing?
Yeah, I think actually my views and David's are probably pretty close now on this issue. I'm probably one of the people that Michelle just described who swings back and forth on immigration a bit. I was pretty restrictionist under Obama and generally in the period when there was this consensus in D.C. that we needed more immigration, more guest workers, that I felt excluded both the reasonable case for immigration limits and a lot of public opposition to those kind of policies. And now under Trump, our restrictionist president, I've recoiled, I think, for sound moral reasons, what I hope are sound moral reasons, from the way that the sort of casually inhumane way that those policies have been implemented. Now, the reality is that some of the inhumanity that we see on the southern border right now was also there under Obama, which is sort of a challenge, I think, for both left and right, and it ends up devolving into these sort of arguments about hypocrisy. But it is the case that any form of immigration enforcement is going to have a somewhat inhumane edge. And as in a lot of public policy areas, you're sort of trying to balance a lot of competing goods at once. And I think there's a way to do immigration enforcement that is less inhumane than what we've had under Trump. And I think the failure of the Trump administration has been its failure to basically prove that you would want a restrictionist president to be able to say, look, we can enforce our laws in a way that's humane instead of trying to rely on cruelty to deter people from coming. And that hasn't happened.
So on this larger question of how far and in what ways the Democrats are moving left, Michelle, I did hear you say on last week's edition of your podcast that as Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris are both rising in the Democratic primary pack, they would actually be building different coalitions. Could you elaborate on those differences?
Well, I think that, you know, we tend to think about Democratic politics in terms of left and right, but when you go out and talk to like regular voters, it's not, they don't see these candidates all on a sort of ideological spectrum from right to left, right? There's a lot of different axes on which you can move in different directions. You know, so when you talk to voters, a lot of second, a lot of people told me that they're trying to decide between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, right? So those are not two people, those are not people who are making a decision on the same spectrum.
Right.
And so my sense is that Elizabeth Warren could make, and I don't think that a lot of those Obama to Trump voters are up for grabs, and that's maybe part of where my calculation about politics differs from David's. But I do think that, you know, her message is basically meeting Trump's phony kind of quasi-fascist populism with genuine economic populism. And
we got Mel to Michelle to say quasi-fascist instead of fascist.
Yeah, so maybe I, that was...
This is a big victory that I just want to note.
Okay, scratch that. Trump's overtly fascist populism.
It came and went so quickly.
And, you know, and so, you know, her message is so tailored to people who are feeling, you know, genuine economic anxiety, who do have this sense that the divide is not between right and left, but between top and bottom. And so could, I think, potentially build a more class-based coalition along with, you know, the kind of upper middle class, educated suburbanites who recoil at Trump and the women who are still traumatized by the loss of Hillary Clinton.
So that's the Warren coalition.
I think that Kamala Harris's potential coalition, I mean, and look, there are obviously huge overlaps. I think the differences are really around the edges. Kamala Harris's potential coalition kind of leans into what the Democratic Party has become. It would be sort of the successor to the Obama coalition, which would be a coalition of people of color who I think are, you know, going to be the backbone of the coalition either way, and then more educated suburbanites, you know, people who despise Trump but don't necessarily want the wholesale remaking of our economy. She would obviously be more, she would be less threatening, I think, to a lot of people on Wall Street, to, you know, sort of the traditional money sources in the Democratic Party. And so, like I said, you know, they're similar, that there's a lot of overlap in that Venn diagram, but there's also some significant differences.
Ross, any idea from you about which of those coalitions, if you agree with how Michelle characterized them, would be more successful than the other against Donald Trump?
I mean, my suspicion is that the Warren coalition would be more successful, that the Harris coalition, even though it would make an effort to sort of use identity politics appeals to turn out minority voters, would be founded much more on a kind of elite social liberalism that's very, very powerful in the state of California and in the city of New York, and less powerful in other parts of the country. But that could just be, frankly, my own wishful thinking, because my own preference, as you can probably tell, would be for the Warren coalition over the Harris coalition, because as a cultural conservative, I tend to suspect that a Harris administration would end up stalemated, as any Democratic administration probably would on public policy, and would be more likely to seek a kind of base rallying through picking culture war fights with religious conservatives, which is what I think the Obama White House sometimes did in the second term. And that's, let's say, my least favorite form of Democratic politics.
David Leonhardt, where do you want to get in on this?
I mean, I think Michelle said earlier that there are not a lot of Obama-Trump voters that are up for grabs, and I agree with that. But it doesn't take a huge share of the electorate to swing it. And I think not only did those Obama-Trump voters, not only were they crucial to swinging the 2016 election, but they then were crucial to swinging the 2018 election back to the Democrats. And if you look at how members of the House, current members of the House, Democrats who flipped districts, ran in places not only like the suburbs of Orange County, but also in Pennsylvania and the middle of the country, they really ran on basically pocketbook issues, more populist in the center of the country than in the suburbs, but pocketbook issues. And whoever the Democratic nominee is, I hope that person can figure out a way to run that kind of campaign rather than a campaign that's about, to just pick one example, Nike shoes.
But come on, nobody's going to run a campaign about Nike shoes, right? I mean, no, it's, of course not.
Do you mean the Betsy Ross sneakers that some take as a pro-slavery symbol?
Has anyone besides Beto O'Rourke been asked about this? Has any Democratic candidate weighed in?
I haven't seen anyone. It's a good question. I guess what, if you compare...
Poor Beto O'Rourke.
If you compare just the 2012 Obama re-election campaign and the 2016 Hillary Clinton presidential campaign... That Obama campaign was much more economically populist. It hit Mitt Romney as a rich guy who's not going to look out for you. That attack was open to Hillary Clinton in 2016, and it's not the one she emphasized. She emphasized that Donald Trump is an odious man, a point on which I agree 100%. But I think the more effective attack for Democrats to take is a version of the Romney attack in 2020, which is he's a rich guy who's not looking out for you, instead of he's a racist liar, a point, again, I just want to say that I agree with. He is a racist liar. I also really want the Democrats to beat him in 2020.
And quasi-fascist, you left that out.
Yes.
Anything else on this?
I mean, well, the one I would say that, first of all, I think that, you know, I spent a lot of time in these swing districts, right, in places like, you know, the Georgia 6th District, which Lucy McBath won after it having been, you know, Tom Price's district and Newt Gingrich's district. I spent a lot of time in Orange County. And it's true that Democrats ran on pocketbook issues, but to some extent they didn't have to run on how disgusting Trump was, because that was the baseline thing that was motivating these women who hadn't been super political before and who, you know, woke up every day and, as far as I could tell, were working 36 hours a day on behalf of Democratic campaigns in addition to raising their families and working full time. I mean, it was just supernatural, the amount of energy that they were putting in. And my sense is that, you know, in those districts, it's not, again, the political energy comes from a sense that Trump is defiling the White House, is deforming their idea of what America is about. And I think that Kamala Harris would be the sweet spot for them, because these are upper middle class women who, again, they don't necessarily want Medicare for all. They don't necessarily, you know, they're not concerned with wholesale economic transformation. They're just concerned with the sort of moral degradation of this administration. That said, there are other places I went in Pennsylvania where the opposite is true, where Elizabeth Warren would, I actually think both of those, either of these candidates could harness the energy that that flipped the House in 2018.
I think that one interesting issue here, which is a point that I've made before, is that in certain ways, for all of the talk about how, you know, much Trump has benefited from the Electoral College and undemocratic features of our political landscape, Democrats are also very lucky to have Donald Trump. Because I think there is, here I'm obviously closer to David than Michelle, I think there is a deep problem for liberalism, not just in the U.S., but around the Western world, where it's going into a kind of ideological cocoon that is as far from where a lot of voters are as the conservative movement often ended up. But that danger coexists with the fact that Donald Trump is, you know, even incredibly good by recent standards economic times, a deeply unpopular president who gives you multiple lines of attack and has multiple vulnerabilities. So I think it's simultaneously possible to believe that the Democrats are lurching left in ways that are bad for their electoral prospects, and that either the Kamala Harris coalition or the Elizabeth Warren coalition could still beat Trump.
Before we take a break, open the phones and play the one clip of tape that I pulled for this hour.
Uh-oh.
Here is some breaking news that actually relates to the section we've just been in. Let me get just like a 15-second reaction from each of you. The news is Tom Steyer is officially running for president and plans to spend $100 million on his bid. For people who don't know, Tom Steyer is the Democratic billionaire from California who's been running those TV commercials for a year now that you might have seen for impeaching Trump. So Eric Swalwell dropped out yesterday, the first to drop out. Tom Steyer just dropped in. David Leonhardt, 15 seconds.
Ugh. I mean,
You didn't need 15 seconds.
Let me say I know Tom Steyer a little bit. I have enormous admiration for his advocacy on climate. He did some things that were under the radar in the 2018 election that were really successful state-based environmental stuff. So Tom Steyer is a force for good in the world. But boy, he should not be spending his money trying to beat these other candidates in the race, which he's unlikely to do. He should be spending his money promoting climate change and trying to help the Democrats get Trump out of office.
Michelle.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's madness. And like David, I respect Tom Steyer. I'm even much more sympathetic probably than most Democrats to his need to impeach campaign and the money that he's spent trying to drum up support for impeachment. He's also done a lot of work registering young voters, which is going to be key to the next election. But I cannot for the life of me imagine what he brings to this array.
Russ Stafford.
I need to say something contrarian. So even though I'm against California liberal billionaires as a matter of principle, I think you could make a case for a Steyer run that basically where he says, I'm going to spend $100 million running a single issue campaign on climate change, which right now only Jay Inslee is sort of doing in the Democratic field. And according to a lot of people, including David and some arguments we've had, climate change far eclipses every other issue in its existential stakes. So Steyer should run and say, I will drop out as soon as all of the candidates commit to making climate legislation their only major priority for the first year. And that could be, I think you could make a case that that would be helpful. The vanity campaign that we're likely to get will not be.
Now, I only hinted obliquely at opening up the phone soon, and already half the people with us on their speed dials have called in. So for the rest of you and the rest of our open lines, listeners, where would you like to enter this conversation with the three New York Times columnists who take part in the weekly podcast, The Argument? Michelle Goldberg, Ross Douthat, and David Leonhardt. Would you like to engage on any of the topics we've mentioned or discussed so far with a brief argument of your own? Or do you have a question for any or all three of them based on today or based on their columns, or any listeners to their podcast, The Argument, want to raise something you heard there? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And like I said, when we come back from this break, I'm going to play the one piece of tape that I pulled for this conversation as a conversation starter. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and our guests this hour are the three New York Times columnists who take part in the weekly podcast, The Argument, Michelle Goldberg, Ross Douthat, and David Leonhardt. And here comes our second reveal from the matching game in the intro. The one who wrote about it being a good thing that Trump humiliated one of his cabinet members. Were you guessing, Ross? No, it was Michelle. I don't want to linger on this, but tell us why.
Well, because on the one hand, it was extraordinarily terrifying when John Bolton, who is widely known as an unhinged warmonger, distrusted even by most Republican foreign policy types, became the national security advisor. And I think for a lot of us, we thought that it was going to augur a newly aggressive phase of Trump's foreign policy. And what it is instead, at least so far, and things could still go completely awry, but what's happened so far is that it has made John Bolton, whose life goal has been starting as many wars as possible, into an accomplice in the most kind of appeasement-oriented Quisling administration that you could possibly imagine. I mean, yes, he certainly maybe has a role in our new Cold War with Great Britain, but
we're going to win. We're going to win that one.
Right?
We always do.
But he's now going to oversee the expansion, or at least be party to the expansion of North Korea as a nuclear power, possibly be the party to the expansion of Iran's nuclear capabilities. And this is all very bad for the world. But it does show that, first of all, very few people who join this administration leave with any shred of their dignity or reputation intact. And, you know, as much as I think Donald Trump is a despicable figure, an existential threat to democracy, and as I said before, pretty much an over fascist, he is actually a less terrifying figure on the world stage than John Bolton.
And so to that point, I pulled one clip of tape for this hour as a soundbite conversation starter, and here it is. It's Trump from last month in Osaka, Japan, answering a question from your New York Times colleague, Peter Baker. And this starts with Baker asking the president's reaction to something Vladimir Putin had just said about Western-style liberalism.
Do you agree with him that Western-style liberalism, as it's been defined over the post-war period, is now obsolete and no longer relevant to today's world?
Well, again, he may feel that way. I mean, he sees what's going on, and I guess if you look at what's happening in Los Angeles, where it's so sad to look, and what's happening in San Francisco and a couple of other cities, which are run by an extraordinary group of liberal people. I don't know what they're thinking, but he does see things that are happening in the United States that would probably preclude him from saying how wonderful it is.
So mostly that answer got derided, and I could see from your faces here as it was playing
I'm here to defend it, Brian.
But derided as Trump, you know, as president of the United States, not even recognizing the term Western liberalism, think it meant what's going on in the Western state of California. But is there, Ross, an important conversation there, either that Putin, as a thought leader 30 years after Soviet communism died, saying Western liberalism is now obsolete, with, you know, something we might call Putinism actually rising in the world?
So no to that. I mean, I think Putin is a really effective political opportunist who has sort of latched on to, you know, ideas of populism and nationalism because they're both, you know, relevant to Russian politics, but also a sort of obvious way to tweak and annoy and divide the West. But I think the idea of Putin as a thought leader is as silly as the idea of Putin as a master manipulator of Western politics.
But on
with that being said, though, yeah, there obviously is a sort of mood of the crisis of liberalism, right, that's abroad in Western politics. And I actually think Trump's reference to California, while obviously evidence that he doesn't know what Western-style liberalism is actually relevant to that, in the sense that, you know, there has been a turn in, I think, left liberal, like Democratic Party understanding of what liberalism means towards the politics basically of California, which means sort of, you know, social liberalism, you know, large-scale immigration, massive inequality, really powerful tech companies. I'm caricaturing here, you know, in order to caricature. But I think some of the debates in the West right now are about whether that kind of Californian liberalism is the default model for all liberalism, or whether there is still room for the kinds of effectively nationalisms and religious conservatisms that were understood to be part of liberalism in like 1957 or even 1985. So in that sense, you can pretzel Trump's comments and actually make it really profound and insightful.
Can you explain what you meant by forms of religious conservatism that were seen to be part of a larger liberalism?
I mean, I think a big question hanging over Western society right now is we've sort of gone through a miniature wave of either secularization or de-Christianization that sort of mirrors a bigger wave that happened in the 60s and 70s. And I think it's an open question how compatible a lot of especially traditional religious critiques or doubts about the sexual revolution are with where sort of official views of liberalism have ended up, right? I mean, we've just, you know, we're in New York City right now. We've just gone through a kind of a massive celebration of Pride Month, right? That has been, in effect, a kind of liturgical celebration, right? You know, flags, parades, marches. It's a civil religion that celebrates a certain form of the sexual revolution. And I think a lot of religious conservatives feel alienated from that and feel uncertain about how dominant that perspective is. And obviously, you know, when it's Michelle's turn to talk, she will explain why, you know, they have a persecution complex and there's no big issue here. But I think that's a kind of example, right? There's been a real social and cultural shift that's most pronounced in elite circles around a lot of social issues where there's a sense that we had these debates, they were settled, religious conservatives lost, and now they're sort of outsiders to the liberal consensus. And I think that is one part, not the whole part, but one part of this larger argument about where liberalism is going right now.
Michelle, I can see from your face, I should call on you next.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different pieces of this. I would obviously quibble with the idea that Pride Month is a liturgical celebration any more than I think that you know, the ticker tape parade celebration of the soccer team is a liturgical celebration of soccer. I do think,
I mean, kind of
equal pay,
right? So yes, I mean, I think that you can have political movements that aren't necessarily meaning to substitute for civil religion. That said, obviously, the liberal project is in crisis. The country that used to be the figurehead for that project is now run by someone who both doesn't know what it is and actively rejects it and wants to align the country with this access of authoritarians. And when I said before that I've been somewhat radicalized by this administration, that's part of why, because if the liberal project is in crisis, then it really is, you know, to quote that like hoary old title of that book, socialism or barbarism, right? And so you do see in plenty of places in the world that socialists have been able to mount a credible challenge to populist nationalism, you know, which to me is an argument for the Democrats to be moving to the left, particularly on economic issues.
David Leonhardt.
I mean, I think you asked Ross, well, in what way was religion part of the liberal coalition in those previous decades? And I think the tell me if you disagree, Ross, but I think the only remaining shadow of it is the role that the African-American church plays in the liberal coalition in the United States. And there basically is virtually no role outside of that for religion in the liberal coalition in the United States. And Michelle, it sounds like disagrees, but I think that's problematic. I mean, I'm not religious, but
Not yet. We've only been doing the podcast for a year.
Not so until Ross converts me to Catholicism. But I think that, look, religion plays a really guiding role in many, many people's lives. And I think it is a problem for liberalism if religious people in Europe and the United States feel as if they have no home in the progressive coalition.
Which I think brings us to the third reveal from our matching game at the beginning of the hour. Who wrote the column on Marianne Williamson being more spiritually important to the left as a Democratic presidential hopeful than many professional liberals realize? It is Ross. So you want to jump in right there?
Sure, because I guess I slightly disagree with David in that I think it's very hard for human beings to escape religion and religious ideas. I think what's true is that institutional Christianity is much less important to liberalism and the left than it has been historically. And people who associate themselves with institutional Christianity, therefore, are more likely to be alienated from liberalism. But religion doesn't go away, right? And so I think the column that you mentioned was about Williamson as not just a sort of slightly weird and absurd presidential candidate, but as an actually significant figure in this kind of, I think it's fair to say, mostly left of center kind of new age religious culture that ranges from Oprah's revival circuit to sort of the spirituality of wellness and Goop and Gwyneth Paltrow to the return of astrology and this, you know, some sort of even neo-pagan flirtations that Michelle has written about. And I think that stuff, I think one of the really interesting questions for liberalism going forward is, does it remain sort of self-consciously secular at the elite level? Does it sort of let more of this religious energy bubbling beneath its Californian surface in? What does that look like? Is there some future schism between the, you know, hard Darwinian materialist Neil deGrasse Tyson science is awesome liberals and the tarot cards and astrology and Course in Miracles liberals? And that's not the crisis of liberalism that we were just talking about, but I think it's interesting and relevant in a way that people in our profession sometimes overlook. And Michelle and I have yet to do the great neo-paganism episode of The Argument, which hopefully we'll do for Halloween.
Well, right. I mean, you know, one of the first pieces I wrote when I joined the New York Times was about the revival of millennial witchcraft.
Yes.
And how you see these occult revivals in times of social crisis. And so it's not that I think that this stuff is unimportant. I mean, sociologically, it's very important. Although Marianne Williamson and her sort of new thought ideology, you know, think it and you can manifest it. I don't know that you can really put that on a left-right continuum. It's also something that, you know, is shot through the prosperity gospel and the sort of big mega churches that in a lot of cases form the backbone of the Republican Party. I don't think that you're going to see this schism on among Democrats, because it's not really about people who are very hostile to religion versus people who are very religious. It's about people who really don't care about religion versus people who still have some attachment to it. I mean, it's just not true that you see day to day in the life of the left kind of any sort of real hostility to religion. In fact, not very long ago, I was at a resistance planning meeting at Chuck Schumer's synagogue in Park Slope, which has become a big headquarters for planning a lot of kind of, you know, anti-Trump actions and in some cases anti-Schumer actions. But it's just that there's a cause and effect issue here. So my belief has always been that the religious right was basically a spiritualized neo-Confederate movement, that it began in reaction, and this is something that, you know, scholars of religion have written about, that it began not in reaction to Roe versus Wade, but that it began in reaction to the IRS in Jimmy Carter's presidency removing tax exemptions for the Christian segregation academies that had sprung up in the South in response to Brown versus Board of Education. You know, if you look at Jerry Falwell's early career, he talks about the biblical basis for segregation. And then you had this long evolution where the movement took, you know, sort of tried to jettison its racist past, reach its arm out to African Americans on the issue of gay marriage. And now it's sort of come full circle, and it is once again a spiritualized white nationalist movement, and obviously the liberal coalition does not have room for it.
But so we just had 2 points. First, you said liberals aren't hostile to religion, which
they're
hostile
to this particular brand of religion,
right,
of course.
Liberals
are hostile to illiberal religion. Right. I mean, that's sort of
a
tautology.
But if the liberal theory is that religious conservatism boils down to neo-Confederate ideology, then we are, I think, in a version of the situation that I'm describing, where conservative Christianity ends up seeing itself as therefore as excluded from liberalism as neo-Confederates rightly were after the 1960s, right? And I mean, I'm not disputing that, you know, a lot of religious conservatives in the age of Trump and in past eras have, you know, that there's always been some overlap with the darker forms of reactionary white politics. At the same time, the history of religious conservatism is really complicated, and my own church's role in it, which sort of ended up subsuming a lot of evangelical energy into the pro-life cause, I think has very little to do with white supremacy. And the charge, I think this is the tendency of liberalism right now, faced with Trump, is to collapse all of its enemies into this category of white supremacy and white nationalism that only heightens the contradictions makes people on my side crazy.
So, Ross, let me say this quickly, because we've had a lot of arguments about religious freedom and whether or not, you know, bakers should be allowed to refuse to bake cakes for gay weddings. And one of the things that people on your side have said is that, you know, this is different than the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement demanded public accommodation for gay people, said you can't refuse to, demanded public accommodation for black people, you know, you can't refuse to serve people because of their race. And Christian conservatives have said, you know, no, this is different. It's different to be able to refuse to serve somebody because of their sexual orientation. But what you now see in the surveys is that conservative Christians are becoming more supportive, not just of being allowed to refuse gay people, but also being able to refuse to serve African Americans. So in some sense, they sort of recognize the same thing I recognize, which is the same thing that I believe, which is that if you cut gay people out of civil rights protections, you're actually attacking civil rights protections as a whole.
No, but this is an example of the cycle of radicalization that I'm describing. And first of all, the polls that you're describing show the number of, say, evangelical Christians saying that you should be able to refuse service to a black person going from, like, you know, 2% to 12% or something.
No, which it's is, much more it, like it, that. It's much closer to like 30 or to like 20.
We'll have to settle this off show. But But the other thing is, I think, look, that trend is bad. But it's an example of what I'm saying, where evangelical Christians say, they don't say refusing service to gay people is different from refusing service to black people. The original argument is refusing to cater or make flowers for a same-sex wedding is being asked to participate, not to serve a gay customer, because the florists and the bakers, the gay customers went to them because they always served them. It's saying, you know, you can't, they don't want to participate in that religious ceremony. Right. Now, you can disagree with that, but if the response to that is, well, that's the same as racism, then the religion, then you can see why you get this cycle of radicalization where people say, well, if that's the case, I guess I have to accept some religious argument for that.
We have to take one more break, and then we're going to go right to the phones with our guests, the three New York Times columnists who take part in the weekly podcast from the Times called The Argument, Michelle Goldberg, Ross Douthat, and David Leonhardt, 212-433-WNYC. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and again, our guests this hour are the three New York Times columnists who take part in the weekly Times podcast, The Argument, Michelle Goldberg, Ross Douthat, and David Leonhardt, and Malcolm in Harlem. You're on WNYC. Hello, Malcolm.
Hey, how's it going, Brian? I'm a huge fan of the show.
Glad to hear.
I just wanted to talk about, I've been seeing a lot of buzz lately about, you know, the third and place Democratic primary candidates, but I think in this talk of coalition, and you know, talking about the angle of attack towards Romney as being that he's a rich guy and he has nothing in common with working Americans, I mean, if we're talking about putting together an economic coalition, I think Bernie Sanders is still, you know, the best candidate to do that.
Why is he better than, say, Elizabeth Warren, in your opinion?
Well, I think Elizabeth Warren, a lot of her, the plans that she proposes, you know, like, all well and good, but a lot of them fall back on a very sort of market-based conception of change. Like, I remember...
And she does, and I'm going to leave it there so we can get enough responses, but yes, David Leonhardt, she does call herself a capitalist while Bernie Sanders calls himself a socialist.
Yeah. I mean, Bernie Sanders has been an enormously successful politician over the last several years, right? He helped move the Democratic Party on the minimum wage. I don't love the free college plan, but many people do, and he's moved them on free college. He's moved them on a whole series of things, Medicare for all. So Bernie Sanders has been really successful. I think he's been a force for good. I don't think he looks like the strongest presidential nominee. And I would say that, one, because I think people confuse how much support he got in 2016 with how much doubt there was about Hillary Clinton. And now that you see a bigger field and it's clear he hasn't locked down all of his supporters, I would be quite surprised if he was the nominee. I would also add that when I have dug into Elizabeth Warren's plans and Bernie Sanders' plans, I have found her plans to be much more detailed, much more rigorous. And so I prefer her plans for populism to his, because I think they're more serious. I also think the fact that she described herself as a capitalist puts her kind of closer to the American swing voter than saying that you're a socialist.
Carol in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really think that this election is something that is going to boil down to authenticity of the temperament of the candidate. And I think that the authenticity of temperament has a lot to do with the rise of Katie Porter. And I'm surprised Barry Weiss is in it on this conversation, because she could add a lot to your talk today. But I just feel that...
That particular New York Times columnist, and Katie Porter, the freshman Democratic congresswoman from California who's making a splash.
I think the temperament of Elizabeth Warren and the fact that she is female puts her at the top of the heap. And the fact that she did declare herself a capitalist even solidifies her cultural...
What is it about her temperament that you're getting at, since you mentioned temperament? How would you characterize Elizabeth Warren's temperament as a winning one?
Well, I put it in contrast, in vivid contrast, to Donald Trump. He's a liar. He's a grifter. He is completely an ignoramus. The barbarian is behind the gate in this case.
But she's got to beat 24 other Democrats first, right? Be the most qualified to go up against that barbarian, or however you want to characterize.
I think the moment has to do with his fake religiosity, his amoral.
Right. You find Warren extremely authentic, I think is what you're saying, right?
I find her authentic. I find her temperament very acceptable to a large range of women and men.
Carol, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. And I'm going to go on to Beth in Margaretville, New York. You're on WNYC. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I really feel that you guys, the media, needs to step up their game in the next year and not get distracted by the distractions, by internal fighting, by personal missteps, by all these sorts of labeling that happens. We need you to explain simply to people in America what's going on. For example, if you're going to call Elizabeth Warren a capitalist, I don't think many people really understand what capitalism means in that regard. What if Bernie Sanders is a socialist? What does that really mean? Let's not talk about Nike sneakers. Let's really parse what's going on. Let's let everybody know what Trump says that's not true. What is that? What is not true? Simple clarity. People are caught up in working. We need you to do that for us.
Beth, thank you so much. Let's go around the table on Beth's remark and talk about how you each see the role of the media, the most constructive role of the New York Times, for which you all work, or the media beyond the New York Times, between now and the election of 2020. David Leonhardt?
So the first thing, Brian, you know this, but I just want to emphasize, we're all on the opinion side. So there's a wall at the Times between those of us on the opinion side and our colleagues who represent the vast majority of the New York Times on the news side. None of us is on the news side. I do agree that the media could stand to pay more attention to policy than we have so far in the campaign. I think it was really irresponsible that the debate moderators in 2016 as a group barely asked about climate change. They asked about the deficit as if it were a greater, longer-term threat than climate change, which I think is just false. And there are tons of really fascinating plans out there, and I would love to see the media pay more attention to the tax plans and the childcare plans and all these things. The fact remains that when we do those stories, and we do a lot of them at the New York Times, they get fewer readers than the other kinds of stories. We are going to keep doing them, but I would also put it back a little bit on readers, that this isn't simply a matter of the media telling people what to care about. It's also human nature to care more about shiny objects than policy. And so I think the media needs to do better, and I would hope readers also drift to those policy stories instead of the personality.
And also, maybe, Michelle, to the previous caller's point, people drift to a sense of authenticity in a candidate as much as they do to the best of the 24 comparisons of policy papers.
Yeah, no, and I think that's really important. And that can also be a trick to cover, because when you're talking about authenticity, you're sometimes doing political analysis as theater criticism. And particularly at a point when most of the analysts were men, the people who seemed most authentic were the sort of people that they had experience sitting at bars and drinking beers with. That said, it is true that people respond to authenticity, and it's one reason why discussing these candidates in terms of all of these discrete issue positions can be a little bit misleading. You know, so is it dangerous that, say, Elizabeth Warren took this position against private health insurance when the polls show that, you know, that that's a fairly unpopular position? And there are dangers in going out on a limb on some of these things, but there are also dangers in letting your campaign be created through a series of poll tests and kind of trying to come up with a candidate that was born in a laboratory, right? Because there's a lot of things, there are a host of positions that Donald Trump takes that are extremely unpopular, you know, from the wall to ending Roe versus Wade. But the overall sense that he has a coherent philosophy among his supporters is very strong. And people can put aside some sorts of issue disagreements if they trust in your overall message.
And Russ, to the caller's point and a little bit to Michelle's point right now, maybe the worst kind of punditry is when anybody in the media sits around and says, well, I think this candidate is more authentic or comes off as more authentic than that candidate, because that assumes that you can read the reactions of so many different kinds of people in America who are not like you, whoever you are.
Certainly
and
not
so,
like us.
So maybe our best role is precisely what the caller said. Do the policy analysis and leave perceptions of authenticity uncommented upon to just people's perceptions.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly now that every political journalist on the news side and the op-ed side is on Twitter, and when we watch presidential debates, we are watching them while receiving a real-time analysis from the strange hive mind of our profession, there's a real danger in spending too much time focusing on things that are essentially intangible, where our reactions may be totally different from the vast diversity of American voters. With that being said, I think one defense you might offer of media coverage that isn't just analysis of policy plans and so on is that we're in a moment of real sort of ideological uncertainty where, you know, the caller said, well, people don't know what capitalist means and they don't know what socialist means, right? Well, we in the media don't know what those mean because people on left and right are sort of trying to define them right now in real time. It's uncertain whether Bernie Sanders' socialism means Denmark or Venezuela, right?
It means Denmark.
I'm being a little unfair. But it's uncertain. Trump's populism, right? I mean, it's definitely the case that a lot of Trump's voters think they understand what he stands for, but how he's governed has been much more conventionally Republican than how he campaigned in 2016. There's a lot of uncertainty about, is there a real populist revolution in Republican politics, or is it just Reaganism, you know, with more reality TV trappings? So I think the media, you know, we have a particular challenge that we need to rise to, but a challenge to sort of describe a policy landscape where things are a lot more up for grabs in certain ways than they were, say, in the Mitt Romney versus Barack Obama election only 7 years ago.
As a closing thought, do you each think your political values have meaning unto themselves? You kind of characterize yourselves politically at the beginning of the hour. Do these political values have meaning unto themselves, or are your values really different because of whose interests you feel responsible to represent as media columnists? Michelle, do you have a thought on that?
You know, I'm not quite sure what that means exactly. I mean, I obviously...
He means who's paying you, Michelle.
Do I feel like I have a certain sort of like lane or a certain role as a columnist?
Are you looking as a columnist at what's right and wrong based on some sense of what's right and wrong? Or are you looking at whose interests you want to represent in your opinion writing because you feel they need to be represented?
No, and to be honest, that might be the more ethical path to sort of try to represent the, you know, unrepresented or people I feel like are unrepresented. But, you know, I'm first and foremost a writer, and to me the act of writing is trying to get your closest approximation of what you believe to be mm-hmm, true mm-hmm. onto the page.
David, same question.
I guess I would answer it by saying I think that in a lot of elite media there isn't sufficient attention paid to the actual American middle class and working class and poor, and that we are in relatively affluent metropolitan areas. Our audience is even more affluent than average for the metropolitan area. The same is true of WNYC. And we sort of, I think, sometimes fool ourselves into thinking that our audience is the country. And so I'm sure I don't do a sufficiently good job of this, but one thing I try to do is think about the ways in which I, as a writer, can push back against my own biases and my audience's biases about what middle class in the country really is, and try to write from that more populist perspective.
Ross, you get the last word.
I mean, I'm in the unique and always exciting position of being the conservative columnist in a newspaper that has a slightly more liberal readership. And so I probably do feel some obligation to, at the very least, explain conservative views sometimes to our readers in ways that, you know, reflect an explanation rather than my own deepest convictions. But I think that
I've hopefully moved away from that over my time at the Times. I think when I started out, you know, I felt more of an obligation to do that. And that sort of the very strangeness of the Trump era has made it feel easier for me to just sort of say what I think and not spend time putting the best face on Paul Ryan's latest plan, because Paul Ryan's latest plan doesn't matter anymore and everything is up for grabs.
And on the words, everything is up for grabs, we leave the world unresolved at the end of this hour with the three New York Times columnists who take part in their weekly podcast, The Argument, Michelle Goldberg, Ross Douthat, and David Leonhardt. The podcast drops every Thursday, right?
Is that right?
Yes.
And so thank you for coming in here and doing a Tuesday edition. I think our listeners are really appreciative of the quality of the conversation that you all just had. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
thank
Brian,
you
for
so
having
much,
us.
Brian.
This is a great show.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. President Trump issued his second tweet using a kind of baby boomer cultural reference for a millennial presidential hopeful, Pete Buttigieg. Trump called him Alfred E. Newman. Now, the first time Trump did that, Mayor Pete said he didn't know who that Mad Magazine comic book character was. Here's that interaction. This is Buttigieg with a Politico reporter saying he didn't know who that was.
Donald Trump today in an interview compared you to the Mad Magazine mascot, said Alfred E. Newman can never be president. What's your response to him?
So I'll be honest, I had to Google that. I guess it's a generational thing. I didn't get the reference. It's kind of funny, I guess, but he's also the president of the United States, and I'm surprised he's not spending more time trying to salvage this China deal.
So who knows? Maybe that was strategic on Mayor Pete's part. You know, I'm from a new generation. I don't get your tired baby boomer references. But then he developed a laugh line about it for when Jimmy Fallon asked him about it.
He called you Alfred E. Newman.
Yeah. You know, we talk a lot about elevating the dialogue. So I guess the fact that I inspired him to make a literary reference, possibly for the first time.
Yes, Donald Trump may not read books, but if he reads Mad Magazine, well, at least that's some kind of literature. But now the sad news. After 67 years of poking fun at senators, celebrities, Donald Trump, Joe McCarthy, and basically anyone in charge, Mad Magazine is closing its funny pages for good, another legacy media outlet that couldn't make it in the digital age. Foreign affairs correspondent for The Nation, Jeet Heer, thinks this is worthy of at least a moment of public grief, and he joins me now with a story, Mad Magazine Told the Truth, about war, advertising, and the media. Thanks for doing this, Jeet. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So as we just heard, Trump compared Buttigieg to Mad Magazine's round-faced mascot, Alfred E. Newman. The insult was at first lost on him. Who was, for the other uninitiated people out there, Alfred E. Newman? Who is?
Well, first of all, I should say that, like, even though I like really dislike Trump, I do think it speaks to his sense of mass appeal, that he knows how to use a reference that can appeal to everybody rather than Finnegan's Wake, which is Mayor Pete's favorite book. But I will say, yeah, Alfred E. Newman was the sort of mascot or main character on the cover of many issues of Mad Magazine. And he's actually an outgrowth of like sort of early 20th century anti-Irish stereotypes, because there used to be this tradition of old comic strips with the sort of freckled-faced, red-haired Irish boy who has the juggy ears and is kind of looks goofy. And his slogan was like, "What's me worry?" And he appeared on starting in the late 50s and on many covers of Mad, and kind of maybe captured the spirit of irreverence or goofy contempt that the magazine had for the world.
Goofy contempt. That's a great phrase. So in a way, he was Bart Simpson before Bart Simpson.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. That's right. Yeah. Mad was the seedbed for like so much of the satire that we see, including The Simpsons. I mean, if you talk to the writers of any comedy show like The Simpsons or The Family Guy or The Colbert Show, or talk to Stephen Colbert himself, you know, they all trace their comedic roots back to Mad.
And listeners, call in. Were you ever an avid reader of Mad Magazine? Do you think that maybe as a teenager it helped establish your worldview? 212-433-WNYC, 433. 9692. Tell us your Mad Magazine memories. How long did you stay with it before you gave it up? Did you have a favorite Mad Magazine feature? Does Mayor Pete remind you of Alfred E. Newman? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. The origin story. Eli Kurtzman, the editor who started Mad Magazine, in your story in The Nation, you call him something of a red diaper baby. Tell us about Eli Kurtzman.
Oh, sure. Harvey Kurtzman. Harvey Kurtzman, I mean, you know, like, you know, he's coming out of the sort of like immigrant New York background. His parents were subscribers to the Daily Worker and, you know, like obviously very left. And, you know, they sent him to a progressive summer camp. And he didn't necessarily share his parents' politics, except that he inherited their kind of anti-racism and sort of, you know, contempt for business culture. But he certainly was more of an anarchist than a communist, to put it that way. You know, he comes into the comic book industry and he's hired by this publisher, Bill Gaines, who publishes a line of like horror comics that are very popular with kids, like Tales from the Crypt, but are also under kind of like legal trouble. He gets investigated by the Senate. But Harvey Kurtzman, you know, his first big thing is like war comics, which are very different than Mad. Like they're realistic, but he brought an anti-war sensibility to comics that hadn't been there. He is during the time of the Korean War, and he has stories that are not just about American soldiers, but about ordinary Koreans, and showing the brutality of war, the killing of civilians, because he said, you know, I don't want to lie to kids about war. And I really see, to expand his operations, and possibly because the war books were so controversial, they started this humor magazine called Mad, which was initially a parody of different comic book genres. So he turned, you know, Mickey Mouse into Mickey Rodent, and he turned Superman into Super Duper Man, this kind of creepy incel who's obsessed with Lois Payne, girl reporter. And I actually think it's the same sensibility as in the war comics, where you want to like uncover the lies. So you want to say like, well, you know, what is this Mickey Mouse? He's really a rodent. And he actually, you know, why does he have three fingers and wears gloves? It's a kind of debunking spirit. And fortunately for Gaines, the publisher, Mad, took off because Gaines was in a lot of trouble. There was a huge kind of outcry against horror comics. And there was, as I mentioned, there was a Senate investigation. Mm-hmm. There was a popular book called Seduction of the Innocent. And there were actually comic book burnings. Parent-teacher associations and veterans groups in the early 50s organized mass burning of comic books. And so for Gaines, like, you know, this was a notice, like, let's get out of comic books and let's get into, like, magazines. And so they turned Mad Comics into a magazine. And we were able to, like, survive.
Peter in Secaucus has a Mad Magazine memory. Peter, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I was a kid in Southern California, completely, you know, white community, and Harvey Kurtzman was my hero. Mad Magazine was my first window into the idea that this corporate world could be laughed at, could be mocked, you know, that these comic books of this mass culture that I was being fed could be made fun of. And so I just grew up loving this stuff. Kurtzman, as your guest is saying, you know, left Mad rather early and went on to found another magazine that Hugh Hefner published called Trump, of all things.
Yeah.
It lasted for all of two issues. It was a glossy, satirical magazine. It didn't work at all. I thought it was great. I treasured my copies for years. But, it had an interesting title.
Do you remember, Peter, any one thing that you know, you can pull out from any edition of Mad Magazine?
Oh, well, it was actually the comic book that I really loved, back before it became a magazine. I do remember, for example, in a one where the they compared a book and a movie. The book is all sleazy and low down and so forth, and they use a censored stamp to cover up all the dirty bits. And then the movie is completely brushed clean, and everybody is upper class and polished and so forth. It was illustrated by Jack Davis, who I thought was the most brilliant artist that worked for Mad in those days.
Peter, thank you so much. Let's go on to another one. Lynn in Fresh Meadows. You're on WNYC. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Brian. I've been reading Mad Magazine since I'm maybe 7 or 8, not that I got all the references at that age, but I recently subscribed to it from an offer on Groupon. The Mad Magazine was my entree into satire, and there was a magazine in the 60s and early 70s called The Realist. Mm-hmm. And I used to read that, and there were satire like That Was the Week That Was, or Monty Python's Flying Circus. I love satire. That's my favorite sort of humor. And I'm devastated that if Mad Magazine goes out totally, that I will no longer be able to see the tooth-missing face of Alfred E. Newman.
Lynn, thank you very much. Your article quotes Kurtzman or characterizes Kurtzman as wanting to use Mad to shine a light on deception and lies in the media as well as politics and big business, but he rejected the notion that Mad had political intentions. Where was that line for him?
That's an interesting question. I think it might – one way to think about it is that I think Mad had a politics, but it didn't have a partisan politics. That is to say, like, you know, he would make fun of, you know, Nixon and Spiro Agnew and Joseph McCarthy, but, you know, they would also go after, you know, John Kennedy and LBJ and Jimmy Carter, right? Mm. Like, there was this so it wasn't like, you know, we're going to be on the we're Democratic comedians. It was like, we're anti-systems comedians. But I think a further line for Kurtzman in particular was he really went after Joseph McCarthy in a really harsh way because he thought, you know, McCarthy was kind of like beyond the pale. But I mean, interestingly, I think he did the parody he did of McCarthy. He turned the McCarthy hearings into a game show. What's My Shine? After David Shine, the lover of Roy Cohn. And did that. The whole point of that story is that it's not just McCarthy. It's like McCarthy has turned politics into entertainment and is able to dominate the TV because he's a great entertainer. And I think that's a lesson that, like, in the Trump era is still relevant.
From a listener on Twitter about Mad Magazine, the indelible impression Mad Magazine left on my life can be traced to a candy store on Coney Island Avenue and Avenue P in Brooklyn. It was there that my 10-year-old self would buy the magazine using my entire weekly allowance, 25 cents, cheap, which I think it said on the magazine, something like that, 25 cents, cheap, before heading into Hebrew school. This listener writes, across the street. At my parents' insistence, I dragged myself there for religious training 3 times a week. Reading the magazine turned out to be far more influential than anything taught in religious school. Oh, boy. So you get the idea. Vina on the Upper West Side. You're on WNYC. Hi, Vina.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I was born and raised in India. And as kids, we were mad about Mad Magazine, and myself and my friends, we all read Mad. And the other thing was Jughead and, you know, the comics, Archie and Jughead. So these were things we grew up with.
Very different, Archie and Jughead, from Mad Magazine, Vina, right?
Right, but we loved both.
Yes.
And, you know, Spy versus Spy was my favorite. I do have, you know, I love Mad Magazine, so I thought I have to chime in.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. I'm going to go on to another one. Nancy in Alpine, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you remember about Mad Magazine?
So I grew up in Cleveland, and we were a family of 3 girls. And we were friends with a family that had 2 boys, and we would trade the magazines. They would get them, and we would trade them. And just also remembering the back cover and how it folded in to make a different image, just a really great thing for the kids to do that now they can access, get online, and see anything pretty immediately. It was something we had to wait for and really treasured it.
Did you have a favorite feature in the magazine that you can recall?
Oh, just like your last caller, Spy versus Spy, huh. You know.
Interesting. Nancy, thank you very much. So this is fascinating, Jeet. If you think about the last three things, we had the Twitter story from somebody who grew up on Coney Island Avenue. Mm-hmm. Then the one woman grew up in India and was reading Mad Magazine, and the last caller in Cleveland. So it says something about something.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, like, I think part of this vast appeal that it had was that it was taking the sort of common culture that kids also saw in the rest of the media, you know, like they were doing parodies of TV shows and movies and you know, sort of like political culture. So it was an alternative world. You know, you had the world of the rest of the media, and then you had Mad, which is a kind of funhouse version of that world. And so it was like very, in some ways, very accessible, but also something that like maybe gave you a different way of looking at that adult world.
Yes.
I was interested in the caller who went to a religious school person, because I think kids read Mad in the way that you read the Talmud. Like, it's like, you know, like you obsessively pore over it, and you like you come across little details because it was so dense.
Right. It was very dense visually, and they would put little things in the margins that would have these, you know, subtle meanings, and that was one of the joys of reading it. Since two callers mentioned Spy versus Spy, would I be right to say that that was a Cold War era cartoon that kind of equated the American spies with the Soviet spies by not labeling them from either side? They just had these little white cartoon spies and little black cartoon spies, and they really did equivalent things to each other. So how's that as a starting point for Spy versus Spy?
Yeah, I think that that's the ultimate, like, that's the, I don't know if that was the intent, but like that's certainly the way it comes across. And it's a way of turning the Cold War into farce. The cartoonist who did it was actually a refugee from Castro's Cuba. Mm. But it has, it belongs to that era, you know, where the Kennedy administration was like doing all these wacky things of like, you know, trying to poison Castro cigars or trying to put itching powder into his beard, right? Like there's a way in which the actual reality of the Cold War was in some ways as absurd as this Spy versus Spy.
Steven in Suffern, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so for me, Mad Magazine, the thing that they did song parodies in many issues. And couple that, you know, in my childhood with Mad Libs, and you know, I'm pretty good at song parodies, but this is the thing, you know, I get the Alfred E. Newman reference to Pete Buttigieg. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking that Mad Magazine could have portrayed Donald Trump as like a very close relative of Damien from The Omen, you know, with three sixes, like an Antichrist figure.
Do you remember?
That's how I look at him.
That's funny. Do you remember any of the song parodies?
I remember one distinctly, and it's got to be, and this has got to be at least very many moons ago. They did one for Kit Willow that was crazy. It was when Nixon, and I'm dating myself here, was when Nixon was in office, and they did a thing with Kissinger, and it was, you know, I had the, you know what, Brian, I had the issue here somewhere.
But you lost it between...
In my collection. It's not lost. I just, you know, you think I could put my hands on it in 2 seconds to read it over the air to you? I wish I was that good.
Steven, thank you very much. You need to get organized. Throw away everything that doesn't cause you joy. Ian in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ian.
Brian, honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mad saved my life. To preface this, I grew up over the hills from Oakland in the sleepy suburb. And Mad was the first place I ever saw gay people, protest signs, corruption, you know, the horrors of addiction. And I knew that I wanted to be an actor, so I would call all different places. I called London and Japan. One of the places I called was EC Publications. It was late in New York, because I was in California, and a lady answered, and she said, "Mad." And I said, "Oh my gosh, you know, who are you? Are you famous? Are you important? What are you?" And she said, "I'm the cleaning lady." And I thought, "Oh gosh, I've really made it. She's going to give me all the dirt, you know." So I called back the next day, and we talked some more. A couple of days later, during dinner, the phone rang, and my mom answered and said, "Mad Magazine is on the phone for you." And I answered it, and the lady said, "Hey, it's the cleaning lady," but I'm not actually the cleaning lady. My name is Annie Gaines. I'm the general manager of Mad Magazine. So she was staying late in the offices because Bill Gaines had just passed away. And I needed a friend because I was a slightly effeminate young kid who didn't have a lot going for me. This started a huge phone and pen pal thing. She would send me packages that I would take to school. Kids thought I was cool. Eventually, I made a trip. My mom took me to 485 Madison Avenue, the Mad offices, and they had a pizza party for me with the artists and the writers.
What a story.
And I got to go home and realize that dreams could come true, and that if I went after something and I really believed in it, you know, I could accomplish it. So I got my braces off, cut my hair, and I became an actor. And I moved to New York many years later, and I'm an actor here. The Mad Crew were some of my closest friends. Nick Meglin, the late great Nick Meglin. Angelo Torres is a good friend of mine up the street. But what's most important is that humor is a way of telling the truth that gets closer to the bone than plain fact. And it also makes you a kinder person, because you have to put yourself in that person's shoes. You know, it's for me, the import of satire, especially now, with political cartoonists being fired and the Times getting rid of their political cartoons and now Mad, you know, it's hard for me not to think that this, what's happening is to, for lack of a better phrase, double plus ungood. You know, it feels very much like the walls are kind of, you know, getting tighter. And for me, you know, Mad was a way to understand scary things. You know, it was sort of the older brother, the cool substitute teacher that would help you to make these giant things like war and you know, addiction smaller, so that you could walk around them. And it, with a laugh, you know, it took the air out of them. And that's really important, I think, for kids today. Critical thinking is what Mad, you know, that's the bread and butter. Question everything, even this magazine.
What a deep and beautiful call.
Yeah.
Your eulogy should be published for Mad Magazine in the cartoonless New York Times. We have to take a break. We'll continue with Jeet here from The Nation right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we're talking about Mad Magazine a few days after they announced they're going to stop publishing new material after 67 years. Jeet here is our guest from The Nation. He's got an article called Mad Magazine Told the Truth About War, Advertising, and the Media. And I'm going to throw in one more tweet, Jeet, after that incredibly profound story that we heard from the caller before the break. So there was, you know, a young gay kid who got one of his first moments of validation from Mad Magazine staff. And somebody else writes, "I read Mad as a child in South Africa, and it was extraordinary for us to realize that you could, in fact, question authority." So these are giving me chills.
Yeah, no, it's a great conversation. And so many, I mean, that last call was very moving, but like so many of the things that people have said have also really talked about the impact. And I really think that, like, you know, Mad was the seedbed of so much of sort of like oppositional culture, not just in America, but throughout the world. And, like, you know, without Mad, it's hard to imagine that there would have been, like, sort of the underground comics and underground press of the 60s, or Saturday Night Live, or The Simpsons. It just seems like it created an entire culture.
Debbie in Verona, you're on WNYC. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, I started reading Mad when I was in fifth grade, and now I'm 75, so that's a long time ago. And what I remember the best is also the parodies. And here's the one that really stuck in my mind for all these years. They did a parody of the songs from My Fair Lady, but it was to reflect on atomic war. So one of the lines was, "Now as I go by, all the missiles fly. Boy, it's rough on the street where you live."
Wow.
Yeah. Thank you for singing. So why is it going out of business, Jeet? Is it just another casualty of legacy media in the digital age because there's too much other stuff like it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, in circulation peaked in 1974, and it's fallen off, but it's actually not that bad. I mean, it has like 200,000, you know, paid readers, which I think is respectable.
I think so.
So it's I think it's a very strange decision in a lot of ways, because it also has this amazing brand. I mean, just from the conversations we've had over the last half hour, there's like, you know, there's billions of people that love it. So you would think that there'd be some way to keep it going. Yeah, I really don't know about the business end, except that, like, you know, like, all magazines are struggling, and it's a hard industry right now.
Bryant in Suffolk County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bryant.
Hey, hello there. It's hard to follow up that incredibly beautiful call from before with some silliness, but Mad was filled with silly for me, and deep and depth at the same time. I love Don Martin, not alone, but along with everything else. And something that stuck with me forever was an amazing sound effect. And the sound effect, the picture is a saw being pulled back, the metal part, and then released, flinging into the face of Don Martin. And the sound effect was foin sap. And that has remained a hilarious interfamily joke, and I still use it to this day.
How do you use it? Give us an example in a sentence.
It's more of a, if somebody drops something or somebody does something silly, I'll just say, "Oh, foin sap." Sort of drop it into their universe. And some people know what it is; very few, but some do.
Gotcha.
I grew up in a house of comedy, so I think this was a hand me down from my brother, my dad. My dad was part of a comedy team called Bob and Ray, so we had lots of laughter and fun around the house, and Mad was part of it.
Brian, thank you so much. Here's another silly one.
Bob and Ray actually contributed to Mad.
Bob and Ray.
Yeah. The comedy team. They contributed to Mad in the late 50s.
And here's another silly one from Twitter. Somebody writes, "My late husband used to tell me that he used to carry the image of Alfred E. Newman in his wallet in defense against his friends who started to carry their newborn children's pictures." Can you imagine that? People are pulling out their baby pictures, their kids' baby pictures, and I have one, and it's Alfred E. Newman.
That's a good joke.
One last serious thought before we run out of time. As you pointed out in your article, Mad decided to stop taking advertising in 1957. So it's incredible that they lasted until this long. What was was there a philosophical reason? And what was their business model without advertising in a magazine?
The practical reason was that Kurtzman made fun of advertisers, so their own advertisers, with parodies, and so they were losing advertisers. Then Gaines said, "Let's turn this into like a strength, right? We'll run no advertising, and that gives us freedom. We can make fun of the cigarette companies," which they did a lot in the 50s and 60s, and a lot of other magazines, more reputable magazines, were afraid to take on cigarette companies and the link to cancer. And so they had this great thing in the 60s where, like, Adolf Hitler endorses cigarettes because he says, you know, they'll kill more people than I did.
Wow.
And so it was freedom. It gave them freedom. But their business model was 25 cents, cheap. They'll get the
there
kids.
There you go. Jeet here, who usually writes about very serious things for The Nation, is the author now in that magazine of Mad Magazine, Told the Truth About War, Advertising, and the Media. Jeet, thanks for the memories.
Oh, thank you. It was a great talk. Very moving.
As we go out with music from the album Mad Twists Rock and Roll, the title song, Agnes, the Teenage Russian Spy.
Oh, Agnes, life's more than I can bear, 'cause Agnes, my Agnes, they're giving you the chair. But even though you are a teenager,
thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.